So I introduced this idea about differentiation of vectors and pointed out the differences between differentiating, I think we better just leave the leave the chairs, the difference between differentiating a real function and differentiating a vector. Now I had quite a good question at the after the end of the lecture, which was the fact that when I'd written t equaled t mu d by dx mu, that was referring to a particular coordinate patch and what happened if you changed coordinates. So obviously if you're in a place where you have a choice of coordinates, some overlap of patches x mu and y mu, coordinate patches, you would want to say that whether or not you chose the x or the y patch, clearly your geometric vector would have to be the same. And so that means that there's a natural relation between these t with respect to the x coordinate basis and t with respect to the y coordinate basis. So all these things are here. This is simply a basis, the x coordinate basis, and this one here is the y coordinate basis. So they're just two different bases for your tangent space at the point P. And since you know this has to be the same object, you see that if I take a little prime to emphasize the fact that this is a different basis, then you see that you end up with a transformation rule between the components of T with respect to the X basis and the components of T with respect to the Y basis. So this was how sometimes vectors used to be defined. They would be defined in terms of their properties under a coordinate transformation. And this would be the contravariant, as it was called. So some of you may have seen this. What's it called again? So these would, yeah, sorry.
Is that the same set of coefficients in your top line, or is it supposed to be T and T dash?
Let's do that to make it nice and consistent. So it's the same vector, so it's just different coordinate, different components. So let's prime that alpha there to make it clear what, you know, or consistent with this. Yeah. Sorry, is that what you asked, or I'm not sure I've answered what you're asking.
Yeah, on this
one, yeah. You would want to prime the T as well, would you?
Yeah.
Well, feel free. Whatever reminds you. The point, what's different between this expression and this expression are the components, the actual numbers in the XYZ, if you like, slot. And so if priming the T reminds you that you're talking about different components, that's fine. But it's not like you have to. It's the same object. That's why I haven't primed it. I'm just emphasizing it really is. This, it's referring to the same thing, but, you know, like I say, whatever works. and then you would have seen for the covector, you might have then also seen that omega alpha prime would be dx beta by dy alpha prime omega beta. So that's another way of defining tensors and covectors and vectors. And therefore, what you would see if you were trying to motivate covariant differentiation, you would see that if you tried to do the obvious thing in terms of differentiating your vector, the obvious thing, so to speak, would be to say, well, let me differentiate along the different coordinate directions. That might be a reasonable thing to try for differentiation. So this would be an obvious thing to do. It's saying, here is my vector field. I've got my coordinate choice. I'm going to take the h, the little infinitesimal change, to just be moving a little bit along each coordinate axis. And then I'll take my limit, and that's my differential. So that's the sort of obvious thing to try. But of course, if we then... Well, know me. Try and say, well, what happens if I change coordinates? Now, here I'm using x prime. Then this would be how I would take my coordinate derivative from the prime basis to the unprime basis. And then I would want to transform my v primed using these contravariant rules. So this would be what I would have to do if I wanted to look at how the object transformed. And then you very quickly see the problem, because when you take this derivative here, it doesn't just act on the V, it's also got to act on this matrix of coordinate transformation matrix. So that's so if I look at the second term, you see that this is dx by dx prime. This is dx prime by dx. That gives you the identity matrix. And so that simply takes you to so now if I look at this first bit, this is the contravariant bit, changing the vector index from the x coordinate to the x prime coordinate. This is the covariant transformation matrix, taking the differentiated index in the x basis to the x prime basis. So this is what you would expect if this thing was a tensor. But this here is, of course, the bit that you don't want. And in general, that's not zero. So this is the bit which tells you you're not dealing with a tensor. And so it's getting rid of that bit, essentially, that is what you do when you're looking for ways to differentiate on the manifold. So when you do a connection, the connection gets rid of that bit because the connection itself is not actually a tensor in terms of, you know, this particular way of looking at things. The connection is a way of linking the tangent spaces together, and it automatically mops up this term that you don't want. The two other ways of taking a derivative that I was talking about get rid of this term in a different fashion. Notice that it's the second derivative with respect to of the x prime coordinates with respect to the x coordinates. So it's symmetric under interchange of these two variables here. In other words, under interchange of mu and nu. So if you could find a way of making a derivative that took an anti-symmetric combination, then that would automatically take care of this extra piece for you, because it would kill it. And so both the Lie derivative and the exterior derivative satisfy this, but in different ways, okay? So let's have a look at each in turn. So what the exterior derivative does is it absolutely, it's upfront. By brute force, it is an anti-symmetric derivative, okay? So I'm saying this, and it just suddenly occurred to me, you do know what I mean by anti-symmetry, you had that definition. Anti-symmetry means if you make a permutation of your indices, the answer you get back is either plus or minus the original, depending on whether the permutation of the indices is an even or an odd permutation. Okay? So for an anti-symmetric here, you've, for example, if you have just two indices, you get a minus sign if you swap them. So that's what it means. Now, if you want to anti-symmetrize something, it means you've got to be able to swap the indices. In order to be able to swap indices, they've all got to be either all covariant or all contravariant. They've either got to be all covector type of indices or all vector type of indices. Since the differentiation is putting an index at the bottom, that's telling you, in order to anti-symmetrize the derivative, it's got to be acting on covectors or something which is covariant. Okay. So let's just start with looking at the simplest example of something covariant, which is a single covector. So, and so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take the anti-symmetrized coordinate derivative. So here, let's just look at, did you get the bracket notation? Yep, great. And the comma notation? Yeah. Okay. Righty-ho. So if we just take that now as our derivatives, then if I look at how that transforms, I can use this expression here in each case. All I've done is I've swapped my mu and nu. It explicitly kills this second piece. And so I'm simply left with what I need, okay? So, in other words, you simply get a copy of the coordinate transformation. Yep.
Why is it covectors?
Because what I need to do is to anti-symmetrize. Now, I can't, if this first slot, if I had a mixed tensor, for example, so, like so, I can't really swap the ordering. I'm poaching on future knowledge here, I haven't said this yet, but I can't really swap B and A here, because if I were to really swap B and A, I'd have to make B go downstairs and A go upstairs. So they're not the same sort of object. One is this vectorial type of index, which is telling you about maps from functions to functions. The other is the covector index, which is mapping you from vectors to reals. They're very different geometrical objects. So you can't, they don't, they're living in different spaces.
I mean, could you add on something that was purely
Yes, you could. I suppose if you wanted, if you were talking about anti-symmetry, you could anti-symmetrize a completely contravariant object. However, I want to differentiate. And if you look at the way the d by dx acts, I was perhaps a little glib here by just simply saying it gave you a downstairs index because it's sort of, you know, lying along the bottom here. But if you also look at what the coordinate transformation rule is, you see that the differentiation index here, the nu, is obeying the covariant transformation rule. So the reason it has to be acting on the covariant objects is because differentiation is a covariant, it's the co rather than contravariant object. Once you've got a metric, you can translate between covariant and contravariant, and then you can start actually getting the two different types of space to talk to each other. But at this stage, for the purpose of defining a geometric derivative, it needs to be covariant because the differentiation process is covariant. Is that a bit better? The way I've introduced it, anyway. This is not the mathematical definition of D. Yeah?
So the derivative is with a two
This two here is representing when you... You mean this one here?
Yeah.
This is representing the fact that the definition of the bracket... So the square bracket mu nu is a half mu nu minus mu mu. Yeah. So that's why I put the two there. So that this is what's on, so that the equation here is correct. So this is what we are going to call D of the form omega, and it's the nu new component of it.
So,
yeah, that's simply an accounting. It's a piece of accounting to make sure that that is correct. So if we think about it, we can take a function now. And we actually can form a covector from the function simply by taking derivatives with respect to the coordinate basis. There's no, if you look at the coordinate transformation rules, you'll see this is in fact tensorial. There's no unpleasant second derivatives because f doesn't transform under the coordinate transformation. And so this object here transforms . So we can certainly take derivatives of functions. So we can take a function and produce a covector. We can take a covector and produce something which is at least tensorial at the price of being anti-symmetric. And this then leads us to this concept of exterior differentiation, where we take any anti-symmetric covariant object and produce another one with essentially one more index. So these objects, which are completely anti-symmetric, covariant tensors, are called forms. So obviously, if I'm making something completely anti-symmetric, can I go on and have an arbitrarily many number of indices on my form? No. Because?
Well, you can't have more indices than you have dimensions on your manifold.
Yeah. Because something is completely anti-symmetric, It's kind of analogous to this idea of linear independence. If you want to swap the indices, they've got to sort of refer to some different degree of freedom. And so we can't have more indices than we have numbers of dimensions. So the space of forms is usually denoted . Call them P forms. So p has to be less than or equal to n, okay? So we use the lambda to represent, the lambda symbol to represent the forms. And the reason for that is because we have, this is a sort of representing a cross product. So if we have two vectors, co-vectors, sorry, then we can make an anti-symmetric product by simply taking our two vectors and ordering them in the opposite way. So you could think of that, if you wanted to have geometric notation, as A tensor B minus B tensor A. So the wedge product essentially takes two 1 forms and gives you a 2 form, or it takes a P and a Q form and gives you a P plus Q form. This is where I need the notes because I always forget the exact. So in general, if you have a P form and a Q form, so the idea with forms is everything's always completely anti-symmetric.
Is this space of p-forms also defined at one point on the manifold?
Yes, I've been kind of... This P is would be defined at a particular point. So you're taking copies of the cotangent space, and you're taking the wedge product is really, you take all the tensor products of, so TP star tensor TP star, etc., etc., and then you subtract off the anti-symmetric, you know, you sort of mod out by the anti-symmetries so that you've got a completely anti-symmetric tensor product of the co-vector space to the required rank. But that, I suppose that's... Actually, I've just remembered, I've used P doubly here, haven't I? So you're quite right. So this is the point P, and the other one is the rank of the form. Thank you for pointing that out. That was... unclear. And then of course you would have the tangent, you would have the bundle of forms by simply taking the union of all of the wedge product spaces at every point on the manifold. So obviously that multiplication is not commutative, because in the simple example of 2 1 forms, 2 covectors, if you swap A and B, you obviously get a minus sign. So what D does the differentiation, by taking a derivative, you're adding an extra covariant index. So D is a map from P forms to P plus 1 forms. And in fact, that's how it is defined mathematically. It's defined, the fact it reduces to just that simple expression on functions, that it's a map from lambda p to lambda p plus 1, and it's Leibnizian. That's right, that's the other. It's got to be a derivation, so it has to be Leibnizian. Let me see if I can just find where I've written those. So in components, you simply take that fully anti-symmetric derivative, and then the other terms are just accounting terms. It's like the keeping all the various factors straight. So this expression here, remember the anti-symmetrization has a 1 over n factorial, where n is the number of indices. So this this kind of takes care of that. And then this p factorial here is a combinatorial factor coming from the symmetries on the A. So you've already met forms. I mean, I was just asking Callum a bit more detail of what you've done. So I think Neil did electromagnetism with you as a means of thinking about, relativity. And, of course, electromagnetism is an example of forms and D. So is that... It is claimed. Is that a correct claim or not?
Not particularly, no.
Sorry?
Not really, because it didn't go over the algebra forms and exterior algebra. It just, like I said, it was a form and introduced
Okay. Well, let's just I'll make a few comments about electromagnetism, because it's quite useful, actually. It's again one of these things where it's a very simple example of the machinery, and it's something which is a familiar physics example, because it's. It's one of, electricity and magnetism are all fairly basic, yes?
Just a little bit of confused by this notation down the bottom. If you consider A to be like an anti-symmetrized placeholder or a form, so some combination of vectors, and you act with D, where does the extra placeholder go?
Sorry,
so say for example you had A1 wedge, A2 wedge, mm-hmm. A3 wedge, and then you act with D, and you, where would you wedge in the extra form component? I don't really.
I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're driving at there. In this case, I'm thinking of A as just a single object. So if you had D of A wedge B, for example, which is what you're saying, yeah? Is that what you're sort of towards what you're asking, no?
Yeah. So.
Well, this would be dA wedge B minus A wedge dB in this particular case.
Okay.
Because you would be, essentially, you're pulling the D through the wedge every time you swap something, commute something in this form language, you get a minus sign. So it's probably a good exercise to see that by actually writing it out in components, because here you would have AA BB minus AB BA, something like that, for example, and you might be taking the derivative there, but then you've got to have all of these different permutations as well. So if you wrote, if you kind of just laboriously wrote down all of the permutations there, you would be able, so this bit here is going to give you a DC AA BD plus AA DC BD, and you would see that they would all kind of pair up into, you know, the expression that you could organize into this format. But don't forget, when you're doing these wedge products, that both DA and DB are two forms. So when you take the wedge product, you have to remember, you know, to do the right expression for the wedge product. So I'm not sure that's exactly answered what you've asked, but it's probably answered what I...
That's exactly what I...
That's what you wanted to know, okay? Right. And that's really telling you, you know, this expression here is actually telling you about how it's, you know, how the form nature of it. If A was a two form, it would be a plus. So you kind of, you know, you every time you're swapping something, you know, the order of things in wedge products, there's a potential for a minus sign to come in. And so you could, mentally, you can think of that D as being, it's not really an object in its own right, okay, because it's a derivation, but you can think of it for the purpose of doing signs, you can think of it as an object which you move through other forms. It's actually a good idea to just try a few examples, and then it sort of becomes obvious. So just as a sort of test case,
doesn't that depend on the number of indices of B?
Yes, that's what I was just saying. This was the example where A and B were one forms. So if A was a two form, it would have been a plus sign. So I was, that was my sort of little, so if you wanted P here, if I can generalize it. And that would be the generalization. So in electromagnetism is an example of a gauge theory where your vector, where you have a vector field is your gauge potential. So, and I think it's actually with my conventions should look like that. So Maxwell had the scalar and vector potential, and you put those together to give a relativistic vector potential, so a four-vector, well, co-vector in this case. And then the field strength is simply the exterior derivative of this potential. So automatically, we get one set, half of Maxwell's equations, by the simple fact, which I've not said, D squared is zero. You also see the gauge invariance for the same reason. So if we send A goes to A plus DF, then DA simply stays as DA. Gauge, that's the gauge transformation. So we call this a U1 gate. Yeah, sorry?
Magnetic monopulsion from an extra term.
Right, so it's quite because we'll be coming back to this with black holes. So I am assuming I've got the, you know, because I'm coming at this for the as an introductory level, I'm making, as you say, lots of little assumptions are being swept under the carpet here, because I don't want to spend ages, you know, defining all the preconceptions here. This says I have a simply, you know, completely connected, non-singular space. So, yeah, sort of, let me just say nice space. We'll come back to it later, what I mean by that. If you put holes in your space, you can get monopoles, okay? But I'm saying that I'm assuming I have a global coordinate patch here. But actually, it's quite good to point that out, because it's often when you start relaxing some of the conditions that you have and making things just a little bit more sneaky, as I would put it, that's when some interesting things start happening. So it's... I wrote it down. I must get it, because otherwise the signs will be wrong. But our stress tensor here is, if we calculate it, okay, so remember it's anti-symmetric, so zeros on the diagonal, minus signs reflecting across the diagonal, and this is saying, you know, it's the electric field and then the magnetic field is what's left in the space-space components. And, you know, we know that we write B is curl A. And so simply, this is making use of once you have a metric, you can actually make use of relations between, so this is like an aside, if you have a metric, you asked me about contravariant anti-symmetric objects. You always keep them covariant, but once you've got a metric, you can relate lambda p to lambda n minus p essentially by thinking about raising indices. And so this is really all that's happened here. You're choosing to label things in a particular way. So there's a lot of nice stuff that you can do with forms, and if you're interested, I encourage you to read further about them. But from our perspective, the only other form that we're likely to meet is very analogous to this one form, electromagnetism. So we call electromagnetism a U1 gauge theory. Because we can couple it to charge scalars, to complex scalars. So phi would go to e to the I alpha phi, and this phase would then, or actually I called it f there, so let me say, put the f there. This phase would be what you would compensate your gauge field with. You would take d of the phase, and that would compensate your gauge field. Here, f is a number. So here, my F is just in the real. So it's like you've got a line. Whereas here, F is a phase. and here it lies on the circle in the complex plane. So this really is a U1 rotation. It is a rotation in the complex plane of a simple phase. So from this, you can also generalize this concept of U1 gauge fields. And I think we've got a question on that in the tutorial. So we can generalize this idea to higher forms. So again, a simple example is where we go from a one form to a two form. And this comes in string theory, where if we have a particle, it just has a simple charge, and that's what generalizes to this U1 symmetry here of the scalar field. So that just couples to a point. If you have a string, you can couple to a two form rather than a one form. One leg goes with time, as same with a charge. The other leg is sort of for the length of the string. So, and in this case, our H, which is the field strength, which is dB, can be written in that form. So although mostly you only come across forms in the context of electromagnetism, you also see them in a more general sense in string gravity. So just for our last topic, what I want to do is talk about the Lie derivative. At first it won't be obvious why this is anti-symmetrizing the differentiation, but once we've got to the end of it and looked at what it actually does, you'll see that in fact it is in some sense an anti-symmetrization of differentiation. So what the Lie derivative does is it takes a derivative along a vector field. So here, you can think of curves which have tangent vector U, and then the idea is we're going to take an object somewhere along one of these curves, our vector V, and we're going to move it along the curve a little bit. So this is our H. Then we're going to compare basically the object that's been moved along the curve with the object at that point. So that's the sort of that's the idea behind the Lie derivative.
Is the Lie derivative related to parallel transport?
No, because parallel transport, by its definition, parallel transport is using the covariant derivative. So in parallel transport, you are using the way the tangent spaces are connected or stitched together to define what you mean by parallel. In this case, what you're doing is you're using the fact that because you've got this vector field U, which is defining a set of curves, you're using these, in a sense, you're using these curves to define a coordinate system, in a way. And that coordinate system, if you move from here to here, there's a very slight change of coordinates, and you're using the idea of coordinate transformations and the fact that your space here is, there's a map between your space here and your space there, that's how you're building the derivative. So let's just go over how you construct it and to sort of see what the ingredients are. So the Lie derivative of V with respect to U and you define it exactly like a normal derivative. I'm sorry, it's running into my diagram, so I'll have to... So what we're doing here is we're saying that here's our original point P. We move a little bit along U, so that's that x naught plus delta t times U. So P is x naught mu. We go to we move a little bit along. So we're moving a little bit along our curve, and that we look at our vector field, the value of our vector field there, then we take the original vector field at the original tangent space, and we want to transform it to the new tangent space, and essentially we do that by a coordinate transformation. So we're thinking about sort of changing coordinates as we move along these curves. So that's the sort of idea of what we're doing. But then we know that xt is given by x naught plus that little bit of u. So dxt by dx naught is just delta mu nu plus a derivative of u. Similarly, v of xt is going to be v of x naught plus delta t got my indices all mixed up here. If I wanted to find out what V does by moving it a little way along, I simply take the coordinate derivatives of V along U. So all I do now, I've calculated the ingredients that I need, and I just put them in. So my lead derivative here . So the first bit is just V at x naught. Plus the derivative of V along U. And the second bit, when I put in what my coordinate transformation matrix is, gives me that. As always happens in this expression, V naught drops out, and so what we're left with is this derivative. You now see the anti-symmetry. You take the derivative of V along U, and you subtract a derivative of U projected onto V. So for covectors, you could get the relation by using the definition of covectors as a map, but if you want to . You always start off by taking the derivative of the object along the U vector field, and then if it's a vector index, it's a minus sign. For every vector index, you take the derivative of U contracted along that index. If it's a covector index, same sort of thing except with a plus sign. So you can build up a lead derivative of an arbitrary object from this input here. So we'll sort of see tomorrow how the lead derivative relates to the exterior derivative, and perhaps talk a bit about why lead derivatives are so nice. Apart from the fact that it takes you a little bit more into the algebraic structure of the space-time, you can also use the lead derivative to tell you, once you've got a metric, about symmetries of the space-time as well. So it's a nice concept, it's a nice object, and we'll see a bit more of it tomorrow. Okay, any questions? Or you're too hungry?